Today on Rocking the Suburbs, we travel back to 1997.
You mean only the greatest year in music history?
That's right, Justin. And if anyone disagrees, it's just the sound of lies. Well, welcome to Rocking the Suburbs. I'm not Jim Lenahan, and I'm joined by not Patrick Foster. I'm indeed Stephen Routledge, and with me today is my musical mind meld brother,
Justin Steiner. We are across the ocean, teaming up once again to bring you a special episode of Rocking the Suburbs. And I think it's good, Stephen, that we're able to drop an episode in here, because neither one of us is unfortunately going to make Suburbs Pod Fest this year. So this is our way of contributing, I think, to the overall experience for everybody who's going to be there. So Jim and Patrick don't have to worry about recording. So,
yeah, no, we don't need much encouragement to talk about music anyway. And this is the fact that we can then justify it by saying we're helping friends out is even better.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a win-win
it's
situation.
It's a virtuous circle, yeah.
That's right. We are signaling our musical virtue right now. And I don't know if anybody caught the little tease there, but what are we talking about today, Stephen?
Well, if they were really on the ball during the intro there, we are talking about an album from 1997, and it's The Sound of Lies by one of my favorite bands, and I know one of your favorite bands, the Jayhawks.
Now, I do believe that you talked about the year 1997 in another episode. Remind us what episode that was and why you did not talk about this album then.
Well, that was back on episode 1044, one of my Patreon episodes, where there'd been a few previous ones where folks had talked about what they thought was the best year in music. For me, 97 was that year. And the reason this one didn't get talked about is because the album was so important to us, and I love it so much that I couldn't justify just giving it a 5 to 10 minute slot, which is what the others got during the discussion with Jim and Patrick. So I said, I'm flagging up that this is also one of the most awesome albums that came out that year, but it will be returned to at a future date. And it was one that you and I were keen to dive into.
Absolutely. I think we figured out early on that you and I both loved this album unreservedly. And I think that was one of the main points that helped to establish our transatlantic mind meld on all musical
Indeed.
Matters.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, so talking of the Jayhawks, then I'm guessing most of the listeners of the podcast will be familiar with the Jayhawks, given that they've appeared on the podcast as guests and their music has been discussed, you know, multiple times. But how did you discover the band? Were you on board from when they first sort of came on the scene, or were you a later convert? How did you?
Well, I remember reading the review for Hollywood Town Hall in Rolling Stone, and whatever was in that review was enough for me to pick up the album on CD, and I fell instantly in love with Hollywood Town Hall and played it endlessly, I don't know how many times. And then, you know, kept going with the next album too, Tomorrow the Green Grass. And we'll talk about kind of where this album falls. But how about you? Did you also start with Hollywood Town Hall, or did you come later?
That was the first one I got, but I didn't get it at time of release. It would have probably been about the year, either late 99 or early 2000. I'd started a new job, and one of my colleagues there was into what most of the other guys called obscure, weird music. And the fact that we were sitting around one lunchtime talking about Teenage Fan Club B-sides probably gives you an idea of the level that we were at there. He mentioned to me about the Jayhawks, and I was like, oh no, I'm not familiar with this band at that time. Mm-hmm. And he said, if you like, you know, what we'd already discussed about, he said to me, you need to get into this band. He recommended Hollywood Town Hall. So I think I got that, loved it, and then I just bought that Tomorrow the Green Grass, and then Sound of Lies very quickly, those three, because I think Rainy Day Music was the first one that I got when it was new,
okay,
rather than retrospectively. And I immediately at the time thought the Sound of Lies was the best of those three, which was not the common opinion at the time.
It was not.
Probably maybe even still not now, I don't know. But I think time has treated it a bit kinder than maybe it was received.
Yeah, well, there's a real demarcation line there, right? So it's interesting that you kind of came to them at a later period, and your listening was maybe a little bit more concentrated to those albums, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I followed along in real time. So Hollywood Town Hall, Tomorrow the Green Grass, which was the same sort of basic sound. And then Mark Olson, who he and Gary Lewis were the two mainstays in the band at that time. Mark Olson left the band. And it seemed, I think at that time, like the band might not even continue. So they kind of had to put themselves back together a little bit on Sound of Lies. Loris had to decide which way to go. You were mentioning earlier before we started recording that they were maybe going to change to another name. I don't know that I recall what that name was going to be.
What it might have been, I don't know. But I do remember, when I was doing a bit of reading up, there was interviews where Gary Loris had talked about the possibility that they might not call the band the Jayhawks anymore, even though it'd be basically the same personnel minus Olsen,
yeah,
because the sound, yeah, the obviously from the start, Olsen was the main songwriter, then Laris became, yeah, there was like the co-writers, and then obviously with Olsen going, yeah, that took away one of the lead singers and yeah, the songwriters. So, but in the end, I think, yeah, obviously they stuck with the Jayhawks, and well, they're still going with us now, so that's that kind of worked out, I think, but maybe after this album came out, they were unsure that they might have made the wrong decision, possibly, given the reception was mixed, I think, probably,
yeah,
fair to say, to this album.
Honestly, I mean, the critical reception at the time was not great. And I mean, I loved those two albums that we talked about so much that when I saw the reviews for the new one, I thought, do I even want to buy it? Like, do I want to hear it and listen to it and be disappointed in this band that I love so much? So I actually didn't buy Sound of Lies when it first came out. It took me, I think, until 98, and I found it in a used CD store. And I was like, oh, okay, here, I can pick it up. And then, of course, I picked it up and listened to it and said, oh, you made a terrible mistake,
because
this
fool.
Album is amazing. So, yeah, it was kind of a slightly reconstituted lineup. I mean, Gary Loris was still there, and Mark Perlman, the bassist. Karen Grotberg on piano and vocals had been there on Tomorrow the Green Grass. That was her first album. And then drummer Tim O'Regan had joined during the tour for Tomorrow the Green Grass. And then they also had a couple extra personnel. They had Craig Johnson from Run Westy, mm-hmm, Run. And he was also in Golden Smog with Loris as well, on guitar. And then Jesse Green did some violin, viola type work. So it was six people working together, although they didn't all play on every track. And Matthew Sweet actually does backing vocals.
He does some backing vocals, yep, on this. Yes, he does.
He does. So, you know, shout out to Matthew Sweet, of course, because we
always
have to.
Always good to shout out Matthew Sweet.
Yes.
Never hurts.
Yeah. So the critical reception was not there because it was a different sound. I mean, the sound before was definitely Loris and Olsen with their two-part harmonies, you know, one taking the low, one taking the high, very more country-ish influenced. And this album is not that.
It is most definitely not, and I think you're right there, Justin. I think that's really why that reception at the time, and indeed now, was not so so positive, because they were sort of, the Jayhawks were one of those bands that were in the vanguard of the alt country Americana movement, as was at the time.
Yes,
and I remember sort of discovering, I think, you know, other bands like Wilco at the time. Oh, this is something fresh. This is like, and that's how. And to be fair, that's how I got into country music, was through the Jayhawks. That kind of led me back through other stuff to get me to Johnny Cash and Gram Parsons and all these sort of things that I wouldn't have got to probably otherwise. This is very different to that. And why don't we start off by taking a listen to the opening track, and we'll maybe understand why we're talking about a different kind of sound to what we're used to.
All right, sounds good.
Won't you take my hand? Won't you be my friend? Take my advice, go away. When the days get short and the chips are down, Will you be there? Will you stick around? Yeah, yeah, yeah. And if thou shalt give, thou shalt be deceived. This traveling band was not well received.
Well, I remember when I first put this album on and I heard those opening piano notes and the opening of this song. And I've had this a few times with music, and I'd be really interested to see what your take is on this. That sometimes you just need to hear a few bars of something and you go, this has an indefinable quality that I know this is hitting the spot for me. Other albums, for example, like Saturnalia by the Gutter Twins, which we may talk about in the future, possibly.
On the list.
Also on some classic rock albums like Rumours or So. But, you know, the first few notes is like, yeah, this has got it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like charisma in an actor. Sometimes music has the same, there's like a charisma for music, I think, almost.
Yeah.
And from the opening notes of this album and with that song, The Man Who Loved Life, it's like, yeah, you got me. Hook, line, and sinker. I'm going to love this.
Well, I mean, piano had been a part of their sound, but maybe not the most dominant part of their sound. So starting off with that piano on The Man Who Loved Life with this album is definitely like a kind of like a signal, like, hey, maybe something's a little bit different here. And I agree, like they're kind of melancholy, the piano coming in there. And then you get that blast of harmony. So you have Grotberg and O'Regan on the harmony, which is a completely different sound than the harmonies that they did. I mean, the Jayhawks harmony was always part of their sound, but it's such a different kind of harmony that they have going on. And you're like, ooh. And then the rest of the band comes in and you get that great bass line from Mark Pearlman on that song. And then Jesse Green's got the violin coming through and you're like, oh,
so many
okay.
good violin touches throughout the whole album. And in my notes for this, I mean, on multiple songs I've written harmonies.
Yes. Oh, of course.
So many times I've written harmonies and backing vocals. But I think what I put my first thing after this song is, you're not in Kansas anymore.
Yeah. Oh, there you go. You know,
yeah. Sort of literally and musically, you know, it's like, okay, this doesn't sound... The album to me splits into two halves, but there's 12 songs and the 6 songs which could have fitted on a previous Jayhawks album and 6 that couldn't. And it's kind of, it's evenly split, but because it hits you with 1-2-3 punch, as we'll get to, of these songs that are very much taken from Gary Lowris's sort of classic rock kind of influences, going back to that 60s and 70s rock and pop that he loved, you know, and those harmonies, very evident of that as well, you know, not the sort of the country type harmonies,
yeah,
the voices working together very much, you know, it just, yeah, hits you with a, like, this is something very different. And the whole album, you touched on it as well, with melancholy. There's an air of melancholy which sits over the whole album, obviously related to the circumstances with the breakup with Olsen. And whilst a lot of these songs are story songs, there's also, you can feel the, yeah, there's so many autobiographical threads woven through those stories.
Yes.
You know, the lyrics that are referring to the story song obviously got the double meaning that you can then take to refer to the split up, you know, and the split with Olsen, you know. And I think that air of melancholy combined with, I think, which is the other key thing on this album and this, and also in this song as well, and plenty of others, is the use of space. I think the whole album and this song is full of, I mean, it's a bit of an oxymoron. It's full of space.
Yeah.
You know, it's full of emptiness.
Yes.
There's so many times where they just let things breathe.
Yeah.
And give things...
Particularly like in breakdowns of songs, right? There's quite a few of them where the breakdown is just, there's not necessarily a whole lot going on. It's just kind of letting it breathe, like you said. And you might get some other elements. I know some people complain of psychedelic elements on this album as, you know, un-Jayhawk-like or what have you. But, you know, it's that space there with those touches, I think, that really kind of makes the album an experience rather than a collection of songs, if that makes sense.
Yes. No, yeah, I think you're right. It ties it all together. Yeah. And certainly with that moving into this song two, Think About It, and then Into Trouble, the third song on the album. There's like a sort of triptych there of just three songs that have all got that same stylistic influence. There's no banjo, there's no pedal steel,
yeah.
There's no jangly kind of like country feel to this. This is rock music that's maybe got a slight little hint in the background, but this is, you know, if you heard those three tracks, you would never say this band had country roots.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. you would not label this album as alt country in any way, shape, or form.
It would just be rock music. Yes. Yeah. And I think the other key thing, again, it pertains to the whole album, and you're talking about Tim O'Regan as well, and we'll come more to him as well, is that the whole band is leaning back on this album. They're never leaning forward. They're always relaxing back into the song, relaxing back into the beat. They're never pushing. Even when it's rocking quite hard, it's not aggressive and ahead. It's always just that sort of, almost like the weight of it is bearing down on them.
Yeah.
You know, that melancholic air we talked about, it's almost like it's pressing down on them as they're playing and into the arrangements, you know. And I think that goes back to what you were saying about how the whole thing is one piece that ties together rather than a collection of songs, you know.
Yeah.
It has that weight across it all, you know.
All right, so let's jump ahead slightly in the album. We'll mm-hmm. skip over Think About It, which another yep. really good song. But let's talk about Trouble. So you said that you thought there were six songs that were kind of new and six that could have been placed on earlier albums. Where does Trouble fall on that spectrum?
I definitely put it in the rock category. Although we are getting to get the hints of the old band start to come through, but they only really get unleashed in the next track.
Yeah.
But we're still mainly in the rock world, I think, with this. Again, the harmonies on the chorus. I mean, this song is possibly their finest individual track out of their entire catalogue. And when it goes into the pre-solo bridge, we've got the stranded on the vine, destitute and shaken, looking for a sign, left hung out to dry, backs against the wall, stoned out of our minds. And then it goes into the solo and you get the harmonies and the chorus. I mean, that is as good as the Jake Hawks get. Now, there's maybe some purists say, oh, no, you've got to go back to, you know, looking for the sun and stuff like that. But no, for me, that is the pinnacle of what they've put on record, I would say.
Well, you know, because in my notes I put, this feels more like a classic Jayhawk song, but then I also thought, maybe though it's not, and it's me, like it's the Jayhawks after this, you know, like this group of people. And so to me it sounds like classic Jayhawks, but it's classic Jayhawks from this album forward rather than the previous two albums.
Looking back, it's classic Jayhawks.
Right.
Looking at it fresh, forward, coming to it new, it's like, no, this is still not what I wanted. Or, yeah, you know, it was what I wanted. But, you know, what the fans or the critics wanted, it's still that. Now, this song can be done in that style because it's very much just a powerful, like ballad type of song. So it could have been done completely differently in that old style, but they obviously chose not to. And, I mean, if those harmonies don't get you in the chorus...
Well, even even the section that you quoted, you know, was stoned out of our mind. On the mind, it's not just mine, but it's mine. It's just a gorgeous little piece as you hit into that guitar solo. So,
well, for those that aren't familiar with that section, let's have a quick spin of that just now.
Perfect.
And remind them of its greatness.
We were stranded on the vine. Destitute and shaken, looking for a sign. Left hung out to dry, our backs against the wall, stoned out of our mind.
I shall never tire of listening to that, Justin.
No, absolutely not.
It's just absolutely stellar stuff.
I mean, you know, in the preparation for doing our episode, I mean, I could have talked about it without, you know, ever listening to the album again, but I've listened to it already a few times, and I know I'm, like, in that space where I'm going to listen to it a few more times, at least here, in the next couple of weeks, just because the songs are so great, and it's in your soul, right? I mean, yes. This album is deep inside, I think, for both of us, but that doesn't mean that we don't need to hear it.
Indeed not, no. And if any listeners not familiar with the album, please listen to it all immediately and then come back and listen to us talking about it.
Yeah.
Because you're missing out in your life in a big spot.
Yep, absolutely.
Okay then. Well, we kind of mentioned that things change once we get onto track four. It's up to you. And we finally get back into sort of the classic sort of Jake Hawks or classic sort of Americana old country kind of sound. We've got great piano from Karen and the violin, which you talked about as well, was strong in this one. But it's still got that air of melancholy hanging over it. You know, it's not...
Yeah.
Although the music is quite perky and upbeat, the beat and the backing track, the body of the track is quite upbeat. When you get those, put the vocals in and the harmonies, it still has that,
Yeah.
That sigh... The internal sigh kind of running through it, you know?
Yeah, and it does. And then it goes into the next track, too, which, I mean, here we are talking about every track, but, you know, we can't help ourselves, people. Stick in the Mud, I mean, talk about the violin and the piano again. Like, those are, again, prominent here. And Stick in the Mud is a beautiful song, but it is crushing as well. It is. Yes. I mean, that one just is heavy. I love it. Because it's so, the music is so lovely, but it is, the lyrics are not upbeat any stretch of the imagination.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you should mention the lyrics. I mean, again, great use of space and backing vocals, consistent themes in this song, but slow and steady wins the race. I mean, it's just that line where he's singing that, you know, and it sounds completely crushed. But that's one of my favourite Jayhawks lines. My all time favourite Jayhawks line is from the next album, from Smile, which is "Before you climb the mountains, first the foothills must appear." Such a classic line. But that slow and steady wins the race. It just, and again, it fits in the song so perfectly. And like you say, it's not heavy musically, but it's got a heavy air to it, hasn't it? There's other songs on the album where the music is much heavier and much punchier and sort of loud. That's not it, but it's got that weight to it, you know. So.
Well, and then let's touch on Big Star a little bit, because that was the single for the album. It was you know, out there at least on some radio. I know they played it on WXRT in Chicago here, you know, in the States, and I'm sure it got some play on other alternative type stations. But Big Star is really kind of where Gary Louris is in his career, right? One of the big lines of that song is, has been at a mere 35, which, ooh, ouch, right? You know, but the band, even though they were beloved, did not necessarily reach a level of commercial success that you
not,
would...
Not
you
that know. They deserved.
No.
Certainly not that they deserved.
Not even close. Yeah. And, you know, they were on a different record label here, too, for Sound of Lies. They were on Deaf American. No, were they on Deaf American before?
Yes, they were.
That's right, they were.
On Deaf American, yeah.
Yeah, it's only later that they switched labels. But, so Big Star is very poppy, very... guitar heavy, you know, but there's a lot of acerbic wit in there, you know. I'm gonna be a big star someday.
Indeed, yeah, that's just, yeah, I mean, yeah, the irony is just perfect. And I mean, yeah, this is out of the 12 tracks in the album, this is the one that straddles the two worlds.
Yes,
it's apt that it's the middle track on the album, or the midpoint of the album pretty much, and it straddles the two worlds. It's got the more traditional sound, but it's got a much more upbeat, as you said. The music is much more upbeat, even though they do bring it again. You talked about breakdowns again. They do bring it down to breathe a little bit at one point, but it's very much upbeat. But yeah, it's not upbeat.
No.
it's a classic one of those, like, you know, yeah, REM is the one I love, or you know, The Police is Every Breath You Take, one of those songs that if you don't listen to it properly, you get completely the wrong end of the stick.
Yeah. Well, and that, I mean, that's such a classic songwriting move, right? To couch the depressing inside of that happy tune. So, you know, you get the tune first, right? And you get hooked by the music, and then it's only after that, when you're already hooked, that maybe you fully process what's going on, and you're like, oh no, but by that point it's too late, right? The drug is already in the veins, and you're you know, there's no way of getting off of it anymore.
Well, I think this was when I first got into the album, this was initially my least favorite of the tracks on the album. I think having seen them do it live a few times since, I enjoy it far more, and I think it works better live than possibly on the record as well. Just because the rockiness of it works better in a live environment, but
it is definitely an outlier on the album. I you know, musically, it doesn't necessarily sync up with everything else.
No, I think you're right, and I know you wanted to talk about the next track particularly as well, Poor Little Fish, and it kind of, for me, the whole album, it starts with a massive peak. It just dips a little bit in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's all relative, not very much, but it's all relative, you know.
Yeah.
And then finishes on a massive peak again, and yeah. So it's a big star, and then into Poor Little Fish. I always found that was the sort of the okay. This is the bit that I'm not so engaged with, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think you have slightly different thoughts possibly on that.
I mean, I liked Big Star, I think, because I heard it on the radio first. Like, even before I bought the album, that was the song that I knew because I'd heard it, you know. So even I think I wanted to, you know, based on that song alone, I would have bought the album, but also the reviews then kind of kept me off of it. And, you know, when you're, you know, in your mid 20s and you only have so much disposable income, you have to, have to make choices, when you are, you know, buying albums. And, you know, it was only a couple months after this came out that my son was born too. So, you know, finances and all that becomes a little bit trickier.
Record purchases, CD purchases was somewhat reduced.
Yes, absolutely. But, you know, I liked Big Star. So when I first listened to the album, it kicked for me. Now, I will say that early on, I don't know how long, because, you know, obviously this album's been with us 24 years or, you know, close to it anyway. I mean, with the world and then with you and I, maybe slightly less than that. But Poor Little Fish was never one of my favorite songs. But the more I've listened to the album over the years, the more I just appreciate the sound. It's kind of where the outro is, where you are is who you are when you're sleeping. I think that, you know, it's nice and lovely there. As like underneath you have some psychedelic type guitars, and it just, I don't know, just the whole vibe of that song really works for me in a way that it didn't. But that's the thing too, right? That's the beauty of music, is that songs can grow with you as you age, or you can find different things in a song as you go along. So the psychedelicness of Poor Little Fish, because it's very heavy vocal manipulation there at the beginning and all of that, can be off-putting, but I don't know. It's wormed its way into my heart over these past couple decades.
Well, it just shows the inherent quality of the whole album, isn't it? Again, that's something that, you know, something that wasn't a favorite to start with. This kind of still gets in there and does its business.
Yes.
You know, and works its magic on you. You know. So.
Yep. The sign of a great album, right? That you can still, all those years later, find something new in it or develop a deeper appreciation for something in the background or a whole track or whatever it is. That's why we love music, right? That's why we listen. Absolutely. That's why we keep, that's, you know, why this community of music nerds is so much fun, because we pass that stuff back and forth to each other all the time.
Indeed, absolutely. Okay, well, let's move on through the album. I think I'll group 16 Down and Haywire together. They're both sort of in the more rocky new sound vein of the two. The only comment I'd really throw out is, again, backing vocals on Haywire, but also on 16 Down, the lean back into the groove and the sense of space in that one is just immense. There's so much space in that song.
Yes.
It's just acres and huge skies of space for it to breathe in it. And it really, they utilize that to massive effect, you know. And from 16 down, we're kind of climbing up another mountain peak of greatness to the end of the album, in certainly my mind.
Yeah. And Haywire, too, I think is really interesting because there's a lot of lyrics about smiling in Haywire, right? And, you know, that kind of leads then to the next album, Smile, which you have your smile when you're down and out. So an interesting, you know, exercise as Gary is moving through the concept forward, of smiling, like what, you know, what is a smile? How do you smile? You know, but yeah, won't you smile? The smile that fills the room with an independent light, you know, but that's all right.
Oh, it's all so good. It's just so good.
It's good stuff. All right.
Well, before we move on to what is the most significant track on the album for me, certainly, let's play a little bit, because this sounds, if you heard this as the first song from this album, imagine this was the days of streaming and you just hit shuffle on this new album and you're expecting Two Angels and you get what we're about to hear. You're going to think, what on earth has just happened? So let's take a quick listen to the start of Dying on the Vine. Okay, Americana, all country, that is not.
No, no, it is not. Not at all.
I mean, it even sounds different from anything else on the album, let alone what they were doing before. But, man, I love this song. I absolutely love this song. I said to you before we started recording, this is in my top 10 all-time favourite songs. And it was in my top 5 at one point.
Which is sad that something pushed it down.
Something this depressing. But don't worry, I've got more depressing songs in my top 10 than this, unbelievably.
I have no doubt, and that's one reason why you are so appreciated, I think, by all of us.
Yeah, I mean, what's your thoughts on this one before I sort of eulogize to the nth degree?
So this one for me, I wouldn't necessarily put it in my top songs off of this album. But there's such lovely touches, right? So the scared of you part, right? Scared of you. That's, you know, again, here we are, deep, dark, and depressing. But you have that. There's that little harmony. I mean, Loris is going, but scared of you. And there's like that little echo. And then you have kind of the counter guitar underneath. I mean, this whole song has kind of like a counter guitar rumbling underneath, right? There's the engine of the song, but it sometimes seems like the guitar is running sort of against the song a little bit, kind of creating some sort of tension there, right?
Yes. That's the thing with this. The whole thing, I think, because I discovered the band not in real time and look back on it, when I heard this album, I was rapidly approaching 30. Mm-hmm. So the whole Dying on the Vine, just the title of the song, kind of appealed to me. It's like, you know, it seemed to be summing up what was happening in my life, you know.
Yeah.
The end approaches, you know, and here we are, you know, 20 years later, and we're still going strong. But, you know, just from that whole intro, I'm a real sucker for a descending progression that you got there with that intro there. The space, again, in the song is used absolutely to perfection. But there's also a sense of menace in this one as well that is not perhaps in the other ones. There's that melancholy, but there's a more of an intensity and just a little bit of like needle or the fact that this could actually kind of just, this song could totally just come around and just stab you in the back if you're not looking, if you don't keep paying attention to it, it's going to creep up on you and maybe do you a mischief, you know? And the drum groove as well, you know, Tim O'Regan's a real star on this song. Even, you know, he's not lead vocal, but the groove on this is fantastic. And the way the solo, it's very restrained. It's not a big flashy guitar solo. And then you talked about breakdowns. You have that breakdown where it just sort of teeters on the brink of, oh, there's a little bit of feedback. And is it, like you say, there's that dissonance. And, oh, and then you think, oh, okay, the guitar's feeding back. Okay, we're going to come back in big. No, we're not. We're going to go right back to the intro with just that little riff coming down and very subdued. It's like, oh, okay, what you expect doesn't happen, but then they do go big at the end.
Yes.
And it does have a musically uplifting finish. The music gets very uplifting at the end, but then it's like, you've got the Scared of You on top of that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just this masterpiece of conflicting sort of themes and sounds and... Yeah, just put the whole thing together.
That guitar at the end really kind of soars through as you're leaving the song, you know.
The whole thing is, the whole thing's just like whooshing up and lifting you up. But he's going, I'm scared of you, scared of you.
Uh-huh.
Like, what? Hang on, what's going on? This doesn't work.
Yeah.
I mean, it shouldn't work, but it works perfectly. It's so good. So good.
Also, I think it's interesting that he includes the lyrics "Dying on the Vine" earlier in the album. I mean, you quoted them earlier too, right? Mm-hmm. So there's that theme kind of running throughout there as well.
Yeah, it's a coherent piece. You know, ties all together. It's not a concept album, but it's definitely of a piece.
Yes.
You know? Well, we talked about Tim O'Regan being a bit of a star on the drums on "Dying on the Vine," and he's even more of a star on the next song. Bottomless Cup, which is the only non-Gary Larish lead vocal, because Tim O'Regan takes lead vocal on this one.
For the first time on a Jayhawks album, he doesn't get one on Smile, but he gets a couple on Rainy Day Music and then going forward from there. So I always love the Tim O'Regan, the songs. His voice, just the register of it, I don't know, it's beautiful for the songs that he writes, and I think he's a great songwriter. Once again, I have to do my obligatory shout out for the Tim O'Regan solo album from 2005-2006 I asked him about through Jim and Patrick when they interviewed the Jayhawks last year.
Yes, that was one of our highlights, wasn't it? Getting our questions put to the
absolutely.
Jayhawks. It's like, yes,
absolutely.
We've climbed the foothills and the mountaintop with that one.
Yes.
It's interesting you mentioned about his voice. Listen, when I was listening again this morning, I think it's got a bit of the Don Henley in his voice. You could hear, go back and listen to Bottomless Cup again, and then imagine the Jayhawks doing like Hotel California or something with Tim O'Regan singing it.
Yeah.
Interesting that they're both drummers as well.
Uh-huh.
But I think there's a bit, you know, whatever you think of the Eagles, you know, most people still agree that Don Henley's got a decent voice, you know?
Yeah, yes.
And yeah, there's definitely a little bit of that in there, possibly, I thought. But
I'll have to listen with a fresh ear again. And
yeah, it only struck me today, you know, all the times that I've heard it and seen them. Like, it's only, maybe it's because I watched on Mike Wagner's recommendation, the Eagles documentary. The 3 hour or 4 hour marathon.
Stephen, you should know that you're not supposed to listen to Mike Wagner. Come on.
Well, he doesn't listen to me, so I don't want to listen to him. Yes. Anyway, that's a nice little bit of friendly banter for Mr. Wagner.
Yes,
he'll come back at us on that one.
We love you, Mike.
We do love you, Mike, very much. And great. It's a nice change of pace, because it's suddenly like, okay, we've got almost the end of this album. So, oh, hang on, there's a new voice coming in here. Obviously, we've heard Tim's voice on the backing vocals and some of these great harmonies that have been going on throughout the whole album, but it's right front and centre. And a slightly different feel to the song as well. because of that, you know, and having a different songwriter as well gives it that different, although it's very much in the traditional mold of the, this could have come from an earlier album stylistically.
Yes.
You know, it's got that slightly different edge to it. So
O'Regan was in a band called the Leatherwoods, I believe, before that, that kind of were in that jangle pop mode. They might even have a track on that Strum and Thrum anthology. I don't know, maybe not. I have to pull it out.
Okay.
That compilation that was released last year with you know, a lot of 80s jangle pop kind of bands. It's a cool anthology. Anyway, that's a side note.
Yes, that's a whole
other
show.
That's a whole other show. Yes, it is. But I think he has some of that, you know, that DNA, which makes him work perfectly in the Jayhawks and in the Jayhawks mode. And he gets to play guitar on it too. So, you know, as well as the drums on Bottomless Cup.
Great, very talented man.
Yes.
Very talented man.
Yes, he is. All right, and then
okay,
we get to the final track, which is also the title track, "Sound of Lies," which. Is again kind of a different sound than what we've been hearing throughout.
Mm-hmm.
Do we want to hear a little bit of the opening here before we talk about?
We'll have a quick listen to that, and then we'll talk about it some more.
It's a matter.
My notes on this were that after all the rock, this is the perfect come down.
Yes.
It's like that wonderful sort of kind of like Sunday morning song with your cup of tea or cup of coffee, depending on your preference, you know, with breakfast. You know, I just need to chill. Mm-hmm. I just need to pause, contemplate the world.
Yes, you know, the acoustic,
and
the quiet.
Put this on as the perfect soundtrack. There's a number of songs that are perfect for that, and this would certainly fit into that category.
Yeah, and it's a very lovely melody from Gary Louris too, and it's kind of it's simple comparatively, right? We just have the Mellotron going, and there's a little of the strings going, and we have the acoustic guitar, and then we just, you know, we get the vocals going on. So, you know, the sound of lies rings funny against the truth. Hmm. You know, that was written in 1997. It can only maybe take on more and more weight in the world that we're living in now. But again, songs can grow with you as you grow and the world grows, right?
Indeed, and we've had a lot, despite how much we've mentioned how well they use space on the album, there's also been a lot of sound and a lot of different sounds.
Yes.
This strips it right back, as you said, to just very sparse arrangement and much more into the the traditional zone we would expect the band to be, and that they've done plenty of other songs like this over the years as well. But it just perfectly just puts a nice, perfect full stop on it. You know, it just, we've had a big sort of crescendo of music towards the end, and it's like the wave has broken, and it's just this just washes us up against the shore, you know, brings us in to finish up, and it's just there's an argument to be made that the upbeat album closer is, you know, is certainly, there should be maybe more rocking album closers rather than chilled out album closers, but I think on this album, yeah, it's the perfect finish, you know, just wraps it up with a bow nicely.
Yeah, and I think if you sequence this song somewhere else on the album, it wouldn't have the impact. It would break things up. So this is where this song needs to be on this album. I mean, you do have more rocking tunes that you could do, but there's that melancholy. And I mean, yeah, this song is melancholic as well, you know, but you got those lovely harmonies, you know, going in the chorus with the three of them as well. But there's no other place that you can put Sound of Lies than at the end of this album for me.
Yeah, and indeed, I mean, I'm certainly in agreement with that. And I'm sure you probably agree with it as well. This to me, this is clearly their best album by some distance. I don't say that any of them, none of the others get close. I would say this is head and shoulders above the rest of the work. Now they've produced an awful lot of good and great music over the years. But for me, none of it has ever quite scaled the heights that this does consistently.
Yeah, they are a band that I love, that I loved before this album. You know, I mean, I think it's hard to separate Hollywood Town Hall and Tomorrow the Green Grass for me, just because I lived them in real time. But yes, to me, Sound of Lies is their masterpiece. It's one of the underrated masterpieces, I think, in, you know, music period, but also in that 90s period, I think it tends to get overlooked, and I think that's a shame. And if you're a Jayhawks fan and you haven't necessarily connected with this album, maybe go back. You know, we've talked about how tastes change, right, and songs hit you, so give it another go. And if you're new to the Jayhawks or the Sound of Lies, you have a lot of great listening ahead of you.
Oh man, if you're new to the Jayhawks and you haven't heard any of their music, then please, you've got a world of wonder awaiting you.
But I think we're typically preaching to the choir here, right? Or at least the Jayhawks choir.
I think the number of people are listening to this who aren't familiar with the Jayhawks will be small, if not insignificant, or indeed zero. But
yes.
Those that love Sound of Lies to the same degree that we do, that may be a different story.
May be.
Well, if you have been listening to this and thinking you would like to comment on what you've heard about our thoughts and tell us how wrong we are, or indeed agree with what we've said, or point out where we've the obvious things that we've forgotten to say, of which I'm sure there are many.
There's a lot here.
You can contact the show via the email, that's rock@suburbspod.com. And on all the different social platforms, it's at Suburbs Pod. You can get hold of me. I'm at Powderfinger71. And Justin, you are?
I'm at Justin Steiner on Twitter.
Okay. Well, I say I've been Stephen Routledge. With me has been Justin Steiner. And I think that there's only one thing left to say. Just be sure to keep rocking the suburbs.
Every day. Every day. Steven, you should know that you're not supposed to listen to Mike Wagner. Come on.